From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Washington delivers its strongest criticism yet of Israel's military bombardment of Gaza.
The shelling of a UN facility that is housing innocent civilians who are fleeing violence is totally unacceptable and totally indefensible.
Also today, last-ditch efforts in Argentina fail to stop the nation slipping into default. And the US issues a travel warning to three West African nations in the grip of the deadly Ebola virus.
It begins as a fever or a flu-like illness where you have a headache, fever, muscle aches and pains, abdominal pain. But very rapidly, it progresses into a more severe form, which is bleeding.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. The White House says an Israeli attack on a UN shelter in Gaza was totally unacceptable and totally indefensible. And it says President Obama is urging Israel to do more to protect the lives of civilians. Meanwhile, the UN says a quarter of Gaza's population has now been displaced by the conflict. And Humanitarian Affairs Chief Valerie Amos says people are simply unable to escape.
No place is safe. The parties to the conflict have an obligation, an absolute obligation, to protect civilians from direct or indiscriminate attacks.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says even if there is a ceasefire with Hamas, the operation to destroy Hamas tunnels used to launch attacks against Israel will continue. He speaks here through a translator.
Until now, we have neutralized dozens of terror tunnels. I will not agree to any offer that does not allow the IDF to complete this important mission for the security of the people of Israel.
Palestinian human rights worker Mohammed Suleiman is in Gaza. He says Palestinians are worried about Israel's decision to call up an additional 16,000 reservists.
Nearly 1,400 people have been killed, with 80% of whom are civilians. So with the news coming that Israel is going to expand its military operation, people are just, you know, trying to brace up for what is coming.
The United States has issued a travel warning for three countries dealing with an outbreak of Ebola. Americans are being warned to avoid unnecessary travel to Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone. The World Health Organization is earmarking an additional $100 million to try and combat the disease, which has now claimed more than 729 lives and sparked the declaration of a public health emergency in Sierra Leone. U.S. officials say they believe there is no significant risk of an Ebola outbreak on American shores. White House spokesman Josh Earnest says the State Department may evacuate two American doctors under observation in West Africa.
The State Department and the CDC are working to facilitate options for potential medevacs for U.S. patients, specifically American citizen humanitarian workers. There have been reports that humanitarian aid workers from the United States have contracted the Ebola virus.
A group of international forensic scientists succeeded in Thursday in reaching the site where Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 came to rest. Fighting between government and rebel forces in eastern Ukraine had prevented that for the past week. The Australian government says it fears there are as many as 80 bodies still littering the crash site. The Russian government hasn't said whether it will renew the asylum offered last year to fugitive whistleblower Edward Snowden. His existing arrangements expired at midnight in Moscow on Thursday. He's filed a request for an extension. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Parts of the British public inquiry into the death of former KGB officer Alexander Litvinenko will be heard in secret, the judge overseeing the probe in London has ruled. Litvinenko died in November 2006 after drinking tea laced with radioactive polonium. Russia denies any involvement in his death. Sir Robert Owen, who's overseeing the public inquiry, says some of the proceedings will need to be held behind closed doors.
Majesty's government holds some documents that are relevant to Mr. Litvinenko's death, but which are of such sensitivity that they cannot be used in open court. The most important issue is that of Russian state responsibility for Mr. Litvinenko's death.
Stunning figures from Italy on Thursday. Youth unemployment has reached an all-time high there of 43.7%. With the details, FSN's Rome correspondent Elena Cassas.
43.7% of young Italians not in work or education. It's the highest rate ever. Prime Minister Matteo Renzi has promised to launch a jobs guarantee for young people in October, but its possible scope is already in doubt. The head of the government's comprehensive spending review resigned on Thursday, saying that while he had been asked to find savings, ministers have made another 1.6 billion euros of spending promises. Carlo Cottarelli said that made promised tax cuts impossible. The Bank of Italy and the IMF this month slashed their growth forecasts for Italy to 0.2 and 0.3%, respectively. Elena Cassas, Rome.
The main news again. The White House says an Israeli attack on a UN shelter in Gaza was totally unacceptable and totally indefensible. And it says the level of civilian casualties in the conflict is too high. And that is the latest feature story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
The shelling of a UN facility that is housing innocent civilians who are fleeing violence is totally unacceptable and totally indefensible. And it is clear that we need our allies in Israel to do more to live up to the high standards that they have set for themselves.
White House spokesperson Josh Earnest with the strongest response yet from Washington to Israel's military operation in Gaza. Israel has come under unflinching criticism from the United Nations, which holds the country responsible for the deadly shelling of UN facilities in the Palestinian territory. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said earlier that there will be no ceasefire in Gaza until all the tunnels Hamas uses to attack Israel are destroyed. Nearly 1,400 Palestinian civilians have died since the fighting intensified 3 weeks ago. Three Israeli civilians have been killed by rockets and more than 50 soldiers have died in fighting. Ruth Eglash is in Israel for the Washington Post and says there's no let-up in the conflict.
This morning, Netanyahu addressed the cabinet. He spoke about continuing on with the army's, with the military campaign, basically to find and destroy Hamas tunnels, which we've seen over the last few weeks extend from inside the Gaza Strip into Israel. Also, this morning, I can tell you that Israel's continued on with some of its airstrikes against targets in Gaza. And Hamas, for its part, has continued firing rockets into Israel kind of at a slower pace than it was in previous weeks, but it's still coming pretty regularly.
Obviously, Israel has been coming under strong condemnation, certainly from the United Nations, who are incidentally meeting as we speak, the United Nations Security Council are meeting to try and put more pressure on a ceasefire in Gaza. They've been condemning these attacks on UN facilities, namely two schools. Israel says an investigation is still underway. So as far as Israel is concerned, we don't have all of the details yet.
From this side, Israel's being very cautious about taking responsibility for the hits on those schools. There was one a few days ago in Beit Hanun, and Israel said that it wasn't responsible for the killing of the people there. Yesterday, they said they're going to investigate the situation, but they've also hit back at the UN, accusing them of allowing Hamas to hide rockets and ammunition inside the UN facilities, of allowing Hamas to fire rockets from nearby or within the school premises. So I think that there is accusations on both sides.
And it's that civilian death toll, among it many, many children, that's putting an immense amount of strain on that relationship between the White House and Israel. The Obama administration condemned the attack on that UN school facility, but stopped short of blaming Israel. And it's also come under some pressure for continuing to supply the Israeli military with munitions for this offensive in Gaza.
I think the US and the UN and other interested parties are increasing their pressure on Israel to try and reach a ceasefire. That, in part, is bringing a lot of tension between Israel and the US, with some Israeli leaders claiming or saying that that the U.S. is not understanding Israel's security concerns, is not accepting Israel's need to go into Gaza to make sure the threat of the tunnels and the rocket fire is completely eradicated. So that is putting a lot of pressure on the Israeli-U.S. relations.
Ruth Eglash in Israel for The Washington Post. In light of the recent attacks on UN shelters in the Palestinian territory, the United Nations has warned that there is now no safe place for civilians in Gaza. FSN's Nick Harper is in New York and began by telling us about the latest stark warnings delivered by the UN Security Council.
Well, some shocking statistics and first-hand accounts we heard from the Commissioner General of the UN Relief and Works Agency, Pierre Krahenbul. He was speaking from Gaza City, and he said that the whole of Gaza was facing a precipice. He said that he'd seen firsthand in the hospitals the catastrophic human cost, and he talked about seeing many broken bodies, dead and injured children, and he said that as a father himself, what he'd seen had devastated him. And it was very much this idea of the human cost of war that this briefing centred around. The fact that more than 80% of the 1,300 Palestinians that have been killed have been civilians. The humanitarian chief for the UN, Valerie Amos, warned that in Gaza today there was no safe place to hide.
The reality of Gaza today is that no place is safe. We have all watched in horror the desperation of children, of civilians, as they have come under attack, with no safe place to go.
The problem being that the borders of Gaza have been closed because of the blockade, and 44% of Gaza is, the Israeli military says, in a buffer zone and therefore liable to shelling. And the UN is saying that these civilians who are being told by the Israeli military to evacuate their homes, to go to UN-run facilities, are not even safe there. And we've seen in the last few days the shelling of a couple of UN-run facilities, with more than 30 people dying and several hundred people being injured.
And Nick, comments also coming from the UN's Human Rights Commissioner, accusing Israel of not doing enough to protect civilians.
That's right. Nave Pillay said that she thought that Israel was deliberately defying international law in terms of its offensive with Gaza. And she said that the other international powers should do what they could to hold Israel accountable for possible war crimes.
I would say that they appear to be defying, deliberate defiance of obligations that international law imposes on Israel.
She also criticised the United States, Israel's main ally, saying the US had to use its influence to try and stop the killing and bring all parties to the negotiating table.
Nick Harper, the UN headquarters in New York. This is FSN Reports. US health officials have issued a travel warning for three West African countries as the deadly Ebola virus continues to claim lives across the region. The World Health Organization put the current death toll at 729. The flight advisory from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention applies to non-essential travel to Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone. Charles Chu is a virologist and professor at the Laboratory of Infectious Diseases at the University of California, San Francisco, and he told FSN correspondent Rebecca Bowring why the current strain of the disease is so deadly.
It begins as a fever or a flu-like illness where you have a headache, fever, muscle aches and pains, abdominal pain, but very rapidly it progresses into a more severe form, which is bleeding. And what you can see is you can see both internal and external bleeding. And you can see, for instance, bleeding from the skin, from the eyes, from the mouth. It eventually leads to severe blood loss, severe fluid loss, that then results in organ failure. And this is why the fatality rate is so high, is up to 90% with cases of Ebola virus infection.
My understanding is that health workers are at a particularly high risk of picking it up. So how is Ebola contracted?
Ebola is transmitted by contact with infected secretions. And really, by infected secretions, I mean any bodily fluids from individuals that have symptoms. This includes sweat, saliva, urine, hemorrhagic vomit, stool, really any infected secretions and close contact can transmit Ebola virus. It is not known to be spread through the air, and that's really important. This is a disease for which there is no vaccine, for which there is no specific drug or effective therapy. And unfortunately, the mainstay of treatment for patients with Ebola virus is supportive care. With respect to development, there is a lot of research being done to develop vaccines. And in fact, there are some vaccine candidates that appear to be effective in animal models, in monkey models. The problem with that is that because of regulatory issues and other issues, it's been very difficult to kind of get those vaccines out to areas of the developing world, such as West Africa, where they're most needed.
Sierra Leone, Guinea, Liberia and Nigeria are all affected by this current outbreak. Do we believe the same strain of the disease to be active in all four countries?
The data so far based on sequencing of the virus, and by sequencing of the virus, I mean obtaining the DNA sequence of the virus and looking and comparing sequences from different strains or different isolates of the virus. The data so far suggests that this does appear to be belong to be the same strain that's causing the disease.
Are you worried about it spreading out of West Africa to other parts of the continent and maybe even here to the US?
I certainly think that we will likely expect to see more of these instances. It's very difficult to control kind of the movement of people. In addition, Ebola virus has an incubation period of up to 21 days, meaning that, you know, patients can be infected without showing symptoms for up to 21 days after getting infected. Nowadays, you can actually travel anywhere in the globe within 24 hours. However, although it may be infectious, it doesn't appear to be extremely contagious. And I think that part of the reason why it spread so rapidly in West Africa is that the countries of West Africa, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, really do not have the infrastructure to be able to contain the outbreak, to be able to provide effective infection control measures and other public health measures to really stop the outbreak. Whereas in developed countries such as the United States or some of the countries of Europe with more advanced healthcare symptoms, I have a feeling that it's extremely unlikely that you will see much rapid spread beyond the initial case.
Rebecca Bowering with Dr. Charles Chu, virologist and professor at the University of California. Now, for the second time in 13 years, Argentina has defaulted on its debt. The country failed to meet a deadline to make payments to a small group of US bondholders in what has become a highly complicated foreign bankruptcy case. The situation has sparked fears that foreign reserves could suffer, inflation rise, and the economy sink further into recession. Earlier today, our Latin American affairs correspondent, Andrea Arenas, spoke with economic analyst Isaac Cohen, who explained the background of this debt and why Argentina has defaulted on its bills.
Well, this is not the first time that Argentina defaults. The first time happened, in recent history, happened in 2001. The problem is that when in any society a person declares that cannot meet its obligations, cannot pay its debt, what they do is they go to court, they go to bankruptcy court, and in court a judge decides how much they will be able to pay. Now, the problem is that internationally that doesn't exist. There is no international bankruptcy court. So the way a default is settled is through negotiation. Negotiations between the bondholders of the government of the country that is defaulting and the government of that country. Now, they need to come to an agreement, and usually the agreement means that bondholders will not get, they will not be paid the face value of their bonds. That is called a haircut, in the sense that the bondholder accepts a cut in the value of its bonds for recuperating at least part of it. But usually, those settlements don't cover everybody, and there are always holdouts. What happens is that as it becomes clear that the government will not pay them, they start trying to sell their debt somewhere else.
Why is it so complicated in an international level? Because the case was brought to a court in New York, correct?
Well, this is the problem, because since there is no international bankruptcy court where you can go and claim your debts from a government that decides to default, then you have to see ways in the, to find ways to make the government pay through other means. And in this case, the court in New York decided that Argentina has to pay. And Argentina claimed that the U.S. court has no jurisdiction, no capacity to take that decision. And they even went to the Supreme Court of the United States, because this is not usual that you sue a government or a country in a domestic court. But the Supreme Court of the United States decided not to review the case. And consequently, the decision from this judge stands. Now, there is a problem, because there are holdouts in other countries, too. There are holdouts in Italy, holdouts in Japan, in other countries. And the question is, if Argentina pays the U.S. holdouts, what is it going to happen with the holdouts in other countries? Because the court in the United States cannot force Argentina to pay holdouts in Japan.
Economic analyst Isaac Cohen with FSN's Latin America affairs correspondent Andrea Arenas. And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, a portrait of a war correspondent. But first, a disclosure. We rather like Christina Lamb here at FSN Reports. She's not only a personal friend, but she also contributes to our programme on occasion. The co-author of Malala Yousafzai's best-selling autobiography, I Am Malala. She's a London-based foreign correspondent for the British newspaper The Sunday Times. There is no one around who knows more about Afghanistan or Pakistan, and no journalist who has spent more time in those two countries trying to understand them. So today, courtesy of the Sunday Times, Christina Lamb explains what drives her to be a war correspondent in some of the most hazardous territory the world has to offer.
So this is my war bag, which I take on my trips. This is my burqa for travelling on the roads in Afghanistan. This is the flak jacket, which we wear. The British soldiers like to make fun and come up and push you here. It could stop AK-47 and armour-piercing bullets. My helmet, phone, and that's been through many wars. First aid kits. Drips, bandages, if you get a gunshot or a knife wound, this clots the blood. And, most importantly, coffee sachets. Sometimes when I'm packing this, you do think, you know, most people in their right mind leave war. Why am I going to where wars are? But once I'm on the plane, then I'm thinking about the story. I was 21 when I first arrived in Peshawar and started covering Afghanistan. I had no idea, really, what a foreign correspondent did. I took a big bottle of Chanel perfume, a big bag of wine gums, Rudyard Kipling's book Kim, and that was more or less it. I basically kind of fell in love with Afghanistan right from the beginning. When I arrived there in 88, the Russians were still there. So then I started going back and forth into Afghanistan with the Mujahideen and started covering war. I'm incredibly curious. My mum would say I'm nosy. I want to see things for myself. And I'm really determined. Like, there's nowhere I haven't got into. Nowhere is like a starting point, okay, for me. I want to tell the stories of people who have no way of getting their own stories told. If I see something that's really shocking that's happening, I want people outside to know about it, and I want them to know about it because I hope that that will change. To me, you know, often the real heroes or heroines in the war are the people that are still managing to educate and feed their children. That's the sort of story I really want to tell, much more than this sort of bang-bang, if you like. I think in Britain we have a lot of interest here generally in foreign news. The Sunday Times has got a great tradition of foreign news. They're not afraid to go against the tide and say this is what's really happening. We have become targets in a way that we weren't. So, you know, if a soldier gets killed in Afghanistan, it's not headlines, whereas if a journalist gets killed, it is. And, you know, it's been brought home horribly to us on the Sunday Times because we lost Marie Colvin in Syria. The most frightening thing that I've ever been in was in 2006, when I was the first journalist to be embedded with the British combat forces in Afghanistan. The minister had famously said that he hoped not a single bullet would be fired. They were going on a mission to a place called Zumbalay. And I was saying to the commander, you know, what do you think about that? And he said, oh, that seems to go quite well. And literally, as he said that, the first shots rang out. Everybody just ran. We were all split up. The commander, we didn't know where he was. The radios weren't working. The Taliban were throwing the mortars into the ditches. All these bullets, things were coming over the top of us. It was incredibly hot. Every direction we ran in, we were being fired at. And I kept thinking about my family. It was going to be my son's birthday that weekend, and I kept thinking about that as I ran. At one point, this sergeant major asked me if I could use a pistol because he said we're probably going to get pinned down and we'll have to fight for our lives. And I realised that the guys I was with thought we were going to get killed. I really, really didn't want to die in that muddy field in Helmand. Nobody got hurt, and it was amazing. This ambush happened, I think, at Wednesday, Thursday. I managed to get back on Sunday. So I arrived at Heathrow, there's my story all over the Sunday Times. And then we went and bought bread and ham to make sandwiches for my son's birthday party. It was incredibly strange feeling to be there and to think that a few days ago I had been in this ditch with all these RPGs and gunfire. So this is a story. You can see there's some amazing photographs by my colleague Justin Sutcliffe. Nobody thought we were at war in Afghanistan, and so my editor realised the importance of the story and so gave me 5 pages, basically saying, you know, this is war. That's where it's great working for a paper like Sunday Times, because it kind of really set the agenda back in England, and in parliamentary questions were asked, and in the end, you know, more troops were sent, more helicopters were sent. I hate that stereotype of the hard-drinking, drug-addict correspondent that comes back and tells war stories in the bar. Having said that, you know, it is addictive. I admit that. And, you know, I've had far more than my 9 lives already. But yeah, as long as I still have that kind of curiosity and interest, I will keep going.
That's Christina Lamb, award-winning foreign correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. You can read her writings at the newspaper's website, thesundaytimes.co.uk, and she co-authored the autobiography of Malala Yousafzai. It's called simply, I Am Malala. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's Thursday's edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, email us reports@featurestory.com and follow us on Twitter. We're there @featurestory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Simon Marks on the bulletin desk. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.